the church's use of technology, and later I was given responsibility for our facilities. I handle multimedia, information technology, GCR's website, coordinated maintenance, and the use of our facility. In other words, I was the guy that you went to when you wanted to get something done in the building or thereabouts. So I say all that kind of in the past tense because although I'm still on staff at GCR, a lot of that has changed. And this is the story of how that changed and why. And I hope that you find some inspiration in it as we work through the story today. You know, I love the verse in Revelation 12, verse 11, where it says, "We shall overcome by the power of the blood and our testimony." It's not that the blood wouldn't be enough, but the Bible tells us that by speaking aloud our testimony and telling others what we've been through, the world can change. People's lives can change, and all kinds of things can happen. And this story is about that. One of my job duties at GCR was to tell the stories of what's happening at our church through video. Now we have a better videographer than I ever was on staff and a number of other people that helped me, but at that time I was the only one. And so in 2008, a man walked into my office who was a member at our church, and I'd known him for a long time, but he was involved with a work that I didn't know very well. And he walked in and he said, "I want to take you to Kenya. And have you helped me tell the story of what's happening there?" And my first response was, no. I'm a West Texas boy. Primarily grew up in cities. My work is technology. I don't see a role for me there. And I'd really never been outside the United States, Mexico a couple times, vacation kind of things, but I'd really had no particular desire to do international travel. But really the deeper reason why it scared me was I had a worldview. And it was a worldview that I'd been taught consciously or unconsciously by my life experiences. And see if this resonates with you, if this is a worldview that you've heard. I believed that as Christians, what we're trying to do is to live very good lives, to take care of our families, to go to church, to be faithful to the Church of Christ, to hang on until we die, and then we'll get to go to heaven and be with Jesus. And if along the way, if you bring some people with us, that's bonus points. That's good, but not necessarily required. And I don't know that anyone specifically ever told me that, but that's what I grew up believing. And I think a lot of people do. I believed, or at least never gave it very much thought about the poor, about people in other parts of the world. Heaven's going to be perfect. All we really need to do is save their souls, and then they'll be in heaven with us. Taking care of their physical needs is very secondary. And so that's the kind of worldview I had. And at the time, I didn't really know that that was my fear, but I think deep down I knew that something might change that and that I would be uncomfortable. And as Americans, you know, we want to be comfortable. We don't want our lives upset. But I was kind of excited about the potential, the travel. My boss at the time told me I could buy some new gear. So I decided I'll go. And so I did. But before we left, I decided to get some information about this ministry that I was going to report on. The ministry is World Bible School. Anyone heard of that? Yeah. World Bible School, classic 1950s old school correspondence course. Teaches people the gospel in foreign countries just by mailing lessons back and forth with Americans. The appeal for the foreign nationals is they get to study with an American. and there's a promise of a Bible or something at the end. Students are enrolled either by newspapers or personal visits or some way of getting those students enrolled. They're assigned to a teacher in the U.S., and they mail lessons back and forth. The student studies the lesson. They answer a test. They mail the test answers back. The teacher grades them and sends a nice certificate and the next lesson. Eventually, the student reaches a decision point, we hope, and accepts baptism and hopefully becomes a faithful disciple of Christ, which is where the problem lays with World Bible School. There's not really anyone on the other side to make sure all that stuff happens. The communication is strictly through the post between the student and the teacher. So one of the difficulties with World Bible School as an evangelism tool is that there's no one on the other side to make sure those things happen and to answer the tough questions. There's not a personal relationship that develops very well. But I get ahead of myself. The man leading this ministry at Golf Course Road was John DeFour. John was an oil man. He worked in the energy industry as an engineer, just a regular job at a big oil company. He worked 9 to 5, worked for decades, just like most of us probably will. He got involved with World Bible School when he was at a church in Corpus Christi, and when he was transferred to Midland, he brought that work with him to Golf Course Road. He chose actually Golf Course Road because there was an opportunity for him to lead that ministry there. So the steady, patient style of being a World Bible School teacher really suited John. Accounting, engineering, those kinds of things, right up his alley. Grading papers, returning them, developing a process for doing all that, becoming very efficient at it. That was right in his wheelhouse. He loved it. But at some point, he became restless because he recognized this limitation that no one was over there finding out if these things were really happening, who these students really were. Was life transformation really happening? He wanted to know what was happening to his students. So he decided to visit Kenya and meet some of his students to see what maybe could be done to make the work better. So a couple years after that, I interviewed John, and this is a part of that interview. Yeah, we will.
One of the issues or problems with World Bible School has always been the fact that you were here and the student was way over there. And we really, you had no way of having someone in country to do face-to-face teaching or follow-up work. In the beginning, we had only a staff person, secretary, who would sort of coordinate the getting of the lessons and the mailing them and the supplying of the names to us. In about 1998 or 9, we started adding one at a time workers in the field, sort of evangelists that we knew of or that had been students of ours, in an attempt to expand the network and provide that local follow-up work. And we've grown it from, originally we started with 2 or 3 people, and today we have 22 or 23 full-time people doing follow-up work scattered around the country. And so the program has grown, and the effectiveness of the program has grown from originally having maybe 10 to 12 baptisms a year to now we have over 1,000 baptisms a year and plant about 12 churches each year. And that's extremely significant. The numbers are so staggering. When I talk about 1,000 baptisms, most people, that will either go right over your head or you won't believe it or it won't sink in, because we don't have access to those numbers. We don't see that in the church here. You begin to fully recognize that, you know, you're not in charge, you're not doing this, you're part of something that's much, much greater, and you begin to feel that you get to see God in action or the Spirit in action, which is something that I think few of us get to see. And so being a part of something in another country and going over and being able to touch it and hug those Christians and sit down and break bread with them gives you a true feeling of unity.
So as you can see, John was part of something that was become staggeringly big very quickly. This was recorded in 2010. Still, every year, around 1,000 new Christians out of the work just being done by the teachers at Golf Course Road in that one part of Kenya. And I know the World Bible School has an impact on millions of people across the world, and this is just one little slice of it. But the rest of this story is what happened after that. You see, John, he had this restlessness in him, and he had to do something about making the situation better. He could have just graded his lessons and coordinated the teachers, but he decided to step outside the box and do something a little different. He went over. He hired evangelists. He hired his students to be evangelists, to go and find these other students and follow up with them and get them involved in churches. But one of John's best students was a Kenyan named Thomas Alwala. Thomas is the son of a Lutheran church preacher. He became a student of John when he was just 18 years old. And he was very passionate about the gospel. He became baptized and began to evangelize the people that he knew. Unfortunately, those were the people in his father's church. And he was extremely successful in converting the Lutherans in his father's church to be in the Church of Christ. So much so that he converted his mother and finally his father in that church building, which sits not far from one of our locations now, is still empty. He actually converted the entire church at age between his 18th and 20th year to be members of the Church of Christ. He lives in a place called Derubi near Sondu in the western part of Kenya. So he organized a church like all of the other follow-up workers that John had hired. Each of them organized these Christians into churches. And churches, when they're healthy, they do what churches do. And one of the things they do is take care of people. And you don't have to go very far in sub-Saharan Africa to find people you need to take care of. One of the most needy groups are orphans. They are literally everywhere. By some estimates, more than 1 million in the western part of Kenya alone. We're talking a country of only 40 million, 1 million orphans. And so every church is doing something with orphans if they're a church worth talking about. And Thomas Church was no different. So let Thomas tell you a little more of that story.
Being under the mango tree. And we traveled through thick and thin to get people. We invited World Bible School students within the community. They came. We conducted Bible studies regularly. And we realized that through doing that, our efforts bore a fruit, and many people start coming to Church of Christ. And we went that way until when it reaches 2000, the church began to think about the orphans and widows. It had been my dream, and I had to sit with the elders down and discuss with them the way we could support orphans and widows. Because every year, the number of orphans that were left behind was exceeding 50. And we had even some in the church, so we had to think of ways that we could assist them.
What Thomas did was give me information. And that's what the Spirit wanted him to do. He gave us information about the problem that his church had, that they had to deal with AIDS orphans and orphans in general on an extremely personal, practical level. How it affected their local church, and this was a new church. that was now caring for, at that time, 45 orphans, feeding, housing, clothing, all responsibility that they had assumed on their own. And part of them weren't even family members' children. They were just from the community, that they had no one, and those two parents took them in. And my wife and I talked about it, prayed about it. And in the beginning, I didn't see there was a great deal that I could do. But we decided to commit some small amount of funds per month, us and Cindy Pennington, wanted to do some assistance for orphans. So we picked Thomas because of my history with him and trust in him, confidence in his honesty, to just give some food money to and said, we want to just help feed these children. We don't want to do anything else other than that, than help with feeding. That's when I lost control. That's when we lost control of it and God took over. God will take, in my opinion, the smallest of your gifts and do great things with it. From that little small gift, God put us in a position to tell the story to others, and others wanted to participate. And we began before long to have more food money than was necessary for those 45. So we began to look at being able to do other things.
Thomas asked John, what do we do about these orphans that have no place to sleep? And many of the orphans were staying with church members, but there were a number that were just sleeping on the floor of the church building, which is a dirt floor. And John said, well, I don't know. What can we do? Well, we could build a building or two. That would help a lot. Maybe a couple of dorms and a latrine. Maybe that would help. And John said, how much would that cost? Thomas says, I don't know. Never built a building. But I'll get an estimate. Okay, get an estimate and write me back. Meanwhile, John tells the story to a family at our church. And that family was deeply touched by everything that had been happening, and especially at the generosity of these church members in Kenya who were already taking care of these orphans. And so they wrote him a check. We met with them. We told them the story. They wrote him a check. The check was for $5,000. So John takes that check, and he runs home. He's very excited. He gets on his computer to email Thomas and tell him that he has a check for $5,000. But before he can send the message, his inbox rings, and there's the message from Thomas with the estimate for the building. And you can guess, it was $5,000. So God had supplied exactly the amount that was needed before either one knew. And so John took that as a sign, and I think probably rightly so, that the Spirit was with them. And so he sent the money, and Thomas built the first buildings at his church site at Derubi. So John is energized by this, and he begins telling more and more people that he knows, church members at Golf Course Road, other Christians, just telling them about all the opportunity there is to help orphans and widows in Kenya, and how little it costs to do it, a very small amount of money. Some capital to get a building started, and then only about $11 a month to feed and house an orphan in one of these locations. And so everything snowballed from that point. Donations started coming in. The other directors, the other follow-up workers in Kenya began asking, say, hey, we've got this church here. It's a stable church. They're taking care of this many orphans. Can we partner with you? Yes, the money is now here for that amount. And John will tell you he can't even remember how many times he'd get an estimate and a donation within just a few days of each other that matched each other perfectly. And so he took that as a sign. I'm on the right path. I'm doing what I should be doing. So that was kind of, I call it a tidal wave of the Spirit that has just, that kind of took over. And as John describes it, we lost control and things began to pick up. So that was a humble beginning for this work in 2005. By 2008, John and his partners in Kenya had built 10 full orphanages and were caring for more than 900 orphans. They decided to hire widows, who are also a very affected group in a tribal culture, tend to be the lowest strata of society. They usually lose their homes and their land whenever their husband dies, and so they hired widows to live there and care for the children and cook, and they pay them a wage as well as providing all their for all their daily needs. So here's where I come in. 2008. I went with John to Kenya, and I traveled around to all the locations and met all the people, and I saw for myself that the world was a whole lot bigger than I thought. I realized that what John had been saying about the work was true, that there were thousands of children, lost and alone, who would die if not for the efforts of the local church, established through World Bible School and empowered by the Holy Spirit and the Americans that were helping them. I was really amazed by the fact that God could use someone like John. John, just a normal guy. He's a bit ornery even. Not a preacher. In fact, when I traveled with him to Kenya, when they'd ask him to speak, he always had about 2 or 3 minutes, and that's all he would do. Just a few things, a very small encouragement, and that's it. He did not want to be that preacher guy. He did not want to be a missionary. He didn't feel like he was a missionary. He was just a World Bible School teacher that had done something, had followed the leading of the Spirit, and done something amazing. I began to think, maybe, if God could use someone like John, who's just a oil accountant, maybe he could use someone who was just a IT person, like me, maybe. So one night, during that trip, I was sitting in my hotel room, and I was... Sorry, I skipped some slides. These are pictures of some of the locations. I came across this picture. I had taken it at a place called Indiba. As you can see, it's a good picture. And that's immediately what I thought. This is a really good picture. This is the best one I've taken. This could very well be the poster image for the work and certainly for that trip. So, like any good geek, I got out the software to see if I could make it better. And I was struck by the reflection in her eyes because it looks unusual. And I thought, okay, I need to zoom into that and see what's going on. So if you look really closely in the reflection in her eye, I couldn't figure out what that was. And then I began to cry because I realized what it was. It was me. I was wearing a hat. We were standing in a doorway. The sun was behind me. The reflection in her eye was me. It's just a photographic phenomenon. It's nothing amazing or spiritual about it. But God used that moment to tell me something. Because as she's looking up at me, she's seeing hope. And she's looking at me personally, she's misplacing it. But the fact she's looking at someone who represents hope to her. And the Spirit spoke to me very loudly in that moment and convicted me that that was, that I was where I needed to be, that I was doing what I was supposed to be doing. And I don't know that I've had that feeling very often before that time. I came to know this girl's name was Lavenda. She was the daughter of one of the widows who worked at the orphanage. She and her mother had lived a very difficult life, and they'd been saved by the establishment of the orphanage in their community. Lavenda was HIV positive, just as her mother was. After that, I traveled to Kenya several more times, helping John just being the one who traveled. John was getting older, and traveling was hard for him. I never agreed to do anything more than just travel to Kenya and help him hold meetings and go to these locations and check out how things were going. I saw thousands of orphans during that time, none of them quite as precious to me as Lavinda. In 2010, the elders at Golf Course Road realized that the scope of the ministry that was going on had exceeded their ability to oversee it. At that time, there was a year or two in there where donations were in excess of $1 million to this work. And it was more than a quarter of the entire church budget. And as good elders are wont to do, they were concerned that, you know, we have one guy and $1 million going overseas. And although we have reports of, when we're sure good things are happening and we don't think there's anything going on, but it's difficult for us to manage and to be feel responsible for. So they approached John and the group of advisors that he had, including me, and said, we would like for you to consider forming a nonprofit to run this work independently. Now, John DeFore has some particular things about him. Some of you are snickering because you know John DeFore, and that's fine. John DeFore did not want to lead a nonprofit. He did not feel he didn't necessarily think it was a bad move for the ministry. I think he recognized that was where things had to go, but he didn't want to be that guy. And unbeknownst to me, he and my wife had been conspiring that I would eventually take over for John. And so when the elders asked us to form the nonprofit, he asked me to lead it. That's a big responsibility, and I'm a geek. Computers, multimedia, video, cameras, that's my world, that's my life. I didn't feel like I had the gifts, I didn't feel like I had what was necessary, but I remembered that John probably didn't either, and yet they'd done amazing things with him. But I had decided, the dark part of my heart had decided that I wasn't ready, and I wasn't going to do it. And then the night before I was going to tell John, I got an email from Kenya telling me that Lavinda had died. She died from pneumonia, complications from HIV that she was born with. And I knew that if I could have some small part in saving someone like Lavinda, that no matter how ill-equipped I was, that I had to do it. So I accepted. In 2011, Kenya Widows and Orphans Ministry was born. So the amazing growth that we had experienced up at that time continued, and it has continued. And today, Quo, as we call it, operates 15 orphanages, providing food and medical care and education benefits for about 1,400 orphans and widows and the widows' children. We also operate an additional 19 locations that provide feeding support only for another 1,200 or so orphans. I continue to be amazed by the fact that God continues to provide exactly what we need when we need it. That's a big work. In case you're interested, it's $40,000 a month. And that's a scary number when you're the guy that counts the money. But every month, there's enough. Even when oil prices are at $24 or $27, when they used to be $120, still there's enough because God provides for us. In 2012, we recognized that we didn't have a good plan within our system for taking care of the kids as they finished high school. Our promise to them is we will get you through high school. And in Kenya, that's a good accomplishment. But there's a whole generation of kids now getting through high school, and it leaves them in a job market with no skills other than what they learned in high school. And so because we had a nice generous gift from the elders at Golf Course Road, we were able to build a vocational training center right across the street from our first orphanage at Derubi, where we teach skills that our orphans can use to make a living, like welding, automotive repair, tailoring, hairdressing, cosmetology, hairdressing, and computers. Thank you. Masonry. See? Got people who are they're taking care of me. This provides them with a way to make a living, even if they decide or are able to somehow get to college or do something else after, they'll at least have something they can fall back on. In the next year, we realized that secondary education at one of our locations was a serious problem because of the quality of the school in that area. Our kids were in classes with about 100 other students per teacher, and their scores coming out of high school were very low. And so we built a secondary school to serve the three orphanages that are there nearby that we continue to operate to this day. Thomas, who you met earlier, now oversees three orphanages and seven feeding stations. He's responsible for the lives of over 450 people. Then there are 10 other World Bible School follow-up workers that we have partnered with to create a system of orphanages based on the pattern that God revealed with John. It's not one that John came up with. It's not a pattern or a system that any of us thought of. It's the one that happened, that God put in place piece by piece with John. And it's this: World Bible School provides the anchor for what we do. There are still World Bible School teachers at Golf Course Road cranking out lessons every week. There are still new Christians coming to Christ. There are a dozen new churches being planted in Kenya because of that work every year. And there are churches that are helping to care for orphans. And when they do, and they've done it for a while and proven themselves, then we partner with them. And we help take up that responsibility. And slowly by slowly, as we gain trust and learn each other and the funds are available, we continue to expand along the model that God has set out for us. So, what did John do that was so amazing? Well, first thing he did, he put his faith into action. He wasn't content to sit on a pew and decide that I believe that and I'm saved and that's enough. He decided there was something he could do that fit his gifts, and so he became a World Bible School teacher and ended up leading that ministry. James 2:14 says, "What good is it, my brothers and sisters, if someone claims to have faith but has no deeds? Can faith save them?" This resonated with John, so he jumped in and did something. Secondly, he used the administrative gifts that God had given him to expand the work in a new direction. He knew how to organize people. He knew how to keep track of what they spent. He knew how to keep all those things. In fact, he kept them in his mind. It was a little scary when we made the transition because he would just write them out on a legal pad each month. But that was his gift. And so he gave his best effort to that work, and it grew because of that. That was his gift from God, and he used it. But most importantly, when things got scary and went in a different direction than he expected, he listened to the Holy Spirit and he went. So when the direction changed from World Bible School lessons to feeding orphans, completely, seemingly unrelated direction, John listened to the Spirit and he went. In James, the very next verse, verse 15, chapter 2, "Suppose a brother or sister is without clothes and daily food. If one of you says to them, 'Go in peace, keep warm and well fed,' and does nothing about their physical needs, what good is it? In the same way, faith by itself, if it is not accompanied by action, is dead." You see, God, through his Holy Spirit, is rapidly expanding the kingdom on earth, even when we don't see it. This is the kind of thing that N.T. Wright was talking about. The church moving in the world is the salvation of the world. He's using his church, even though it's filled with broken, sinful people, to be his hands and feet. And all we have to do is join him. John did that by going into the world and making disciples. Those people became disciples, real disciples who followed Christ, who took care of people. And then God took control of his efforts. So I asked him, when I recorded this interview with him back in 2010, I said, John, did you think what you were doing was going to change the world? And this is what he said.
No. No. I just feel like we're doing what we're supposed to be doing. To me, it makes you feel good about giving. And that's how we're supposed to feel. When we give money to God, and that's what this money is for, we're supposed to feel good about it. It's supposed to bring us joy. So we're changing the world for these 1,450 people, but as far as the world and its 6 billion or however many it has, no, I'm not changing the world, but it's the model that would if we all were involved in this kind of work. The world would be changed in a pretty rapid fashion, I think.
It's the model that would.
As if we just thought of it. The model that God created a long, long time ago. Share the gospel with everyone you can, by whatever means you can. Put your whole effort into it. Help establish churches. They'll know what to do. Support them. And watch them change the world. Recently in Kenya, just about 4 weeks ago, and we were filming with Matt Maxwell, who's the videographer who's replaced me at Golf Course Road. And we're filming some of the stories of one of the particular locations that we help. And we were there at the scene of an atrocity that happened in Kenya back during the 2007 election. There was a disputed election, political crisis, and there was violence. And people who were of the wrong tribe, who were on the wrong side of the line, were caught in a bad situation. There was one location where, called Kiamba, where about 150 people sought refuge in a church building from the tribal warriors that were attacking them. And they thought they would be safe there because no one attacks churches. Unfortunately, those warriors had never heard that, and so they burned the church building down with them in it. It's a horrific act. The United Nations Human Rights Council has listed it as a war atrocity, and 50 people died in that church building that day. As it turns out, 5 of the people who survived made it to what would later become one of our feeding stations. It was a group of refugees that we found. It's a very long story, but a very good one. We're working on a video to tell. But so 5 of these people had made it out of there and had made it out alive. And eventually we got hooked up with them a couple years later after they'd been in a lot of trouble just trying to survive, and were able to establish a feeding station with them. And then next month they'll become the 15th orphanage in our system. And we were there shooting some video of those survivors. We had 4 of them. The 5th one was not there until we were almost done. And then this girl, who's 19, maybe 20, comes riding up on the back of a motorcycle taxi. And she jumps off and hugs the other survivors that were there. And then they tell me this is the 5th survivor. Her name is Irene. Irene was in the fire. She was able to get out pretty quick. She was not injured. Although several other of our people were. Irene was able to finish high school because of the work that we're doing. If we weren't doing it, or if we'd never met them, Irene would not have finished high school. If she had not ended up in that church on that horrible day, she would still be living with her parents, most likely, married off to someone. Living in a farm, living a very difficult life. But instead, a bad thing happened, and she ended up being cared for. She finished secondary school, and she went to our vocational training center, and she graduated from our catering program teaches hospitality skills for restaurant in the restaurant industry. And she was late arriving that day because she was coming from work. She worked at a restaurant in a town right near the one where she was when her mother and her uncle lost their lives in that church building. And she didn't have to go back there. She didn't have any land there. She didn't have any reason to go back there. But she wanted to go back there. She wanted to show them that she wasn't afraid and that evil doesn't win. So here's a person that God, that it looked like was going to have a very difficult life. And a horrible thing happened to him. It reminded me so much of the story of Job, especially at the end of Job. All these bad things that happened to Job, and then God replaced everything. And then twice as much. We don't serve a God that just fixes things. He makes them twice as good as they were before. So Irene was a great reminder that what we're doing matters, and that God fulfills His promises. That if we're faithful to make disciples and to follow the direction of the Holy Spirit, He's going to do amazing things with it, and He will change the world. So I appreciate you listening. I have some brochures here who tell a little bit more about the work that KWO is still doing in Kenya. And we have one more minute. So if you have a question or two.
What's the structure among the Kenyans for running this thing?
It's a very loose structure. We have the directors who are former World Bible School workers. In some cases, they still are. They typically act as evangelists over a number of churches, four or five in their area. They live on site at the orphanage, and they take care of the day-to-day activities there. We send funds through our administrative oversight person, who was actually also the coordinator for World Bible School in Kenya, Maureen Luvi, and she distributes them. And we have a person, a couple, Stephen and Mercy, who travel around at my direction and inspect. Basically, they're just popping in, making sure things are happening, checking on the things that are hot buttons for us, counseling the kids. Stephen has a counseling certificate, and checking books and doing that kind of thing. I travel to Kenya 4 or 5 times a year. They're about 12 to 14 weeks. So we don't employ anyone that's unnecessary. We don't employ anyone in the United States except a part-time bookkeeper. Golf Course Road still pays for me to do this work, and everyone else in Kenya is directly involved in caring for orphans. There's not really a structure above them. So, that answer your question?
And so, and most of the kids, you said some are 8 orphans. I guess my first question is, why are the orphans?
Well, mostly, probably about half of them are from the AIDS epidemic. The way it swept through Africa was devastating and very quick. The thing about AIDS that made it so difficult was it strikes the most active members of the population base, the ones who should be caring for children and their aged parents are wiped out. It's like a big chunk of one generation, my generation, basically. It was completely erased. And so that left not only orphans with no one to go to, but even if they had a grandparent, they likely wouldn't have the ability to support them. They would be expecting to be supported by their children who had passed. Some of them, their parents died in road accidents, tuberculosis, malaria, unknown diseases, rarely cancer, but usually it's AIDS, and yeah, they don't really live long enough for that. But, good. Any other questions?
And healthcare for the kids?
Healthcare. We have a reserve fund that we provide healthcare funds that we send a small amount for them to use on routine things. Each of our orphanages has a clinic on site. We usually have a part-time nurse that comes in daily to check on the kids and to do take care of the basic needs. Otherwise, we take them to local dispensaries or hospitals nearby for that. We also make 3 or 4 medical trips a year where we bring doctors, dentists, and some of the support personnel will go to one of the areas where we have a number of orphanages and base there, and then and do medical triage, well checks, whatever we can do that's active at that time, do some training with the nurses, and do dental care during those trips. Anyone else? Well, I hope you've been encouraged by this. The point of doing it, you know, we'd love to tell the story about Quo and what God is doing with that. The point for you, I hope, is that the church is the salvation of the world. And anything that you do that helps make disciples that become churches will help change the world as long as they get the support they need. So if you'd like some information, you can pick it up on the way out. And if you have any questions, I'll just hang around after and you can ask them. So thanks for being here.